The weekend after Thanksgiving, I'll be heading to Nashville, Tennessee, my old stomping ground, to talk to a family to preserve the memories of their mom and dad, the matriarch and the patriarch, as a lovely gift for the mother's 80th birthday, and also just in time for Christmas. If it's something you're interested in, check out voicelocket.com. It's an unforgettable memory, and it's something that can't be replicated. Very deeply personal. Voicelocket.com. Now the show.
I think that's part of the strength of being a good doctor is that it should always be a little bit hard.
This is In Her Words, a podcast from manlisting.com, featuring one man listening to the stories of real women in their own words. In Her Words, a conversation worth hearing because every woman deserves to be heard.
Hey there, and welcome to In Her Words, the podcast, the 198th consecutive, or excuse me, 199. This is 199. Next week is 200, and we'll have a very special episode. And this week, the first repeat, and it bears repeating, in 199 episodes, because Dr. Alice Yu, my kid's buddy, Dr. Alice Yu, MD, who went from Chapel Hill to Duke for medical school and now is up at Northwestern doing her residency, decided to compete in the Miss Asian Chicago pageant, and she won. She was named Queen, and when I talked to her, she is so talented, so beautiful, and so brilliant in music, and just a wide science, obviously, the arts and the sciences, that the conversation was so wide-ranging that I wanted you to get a reprise. I wanted you, for those of you who have not heard it, to hear it. Alice Yu, MD.
Where were you born?
I was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi.
Hospital or home?
Hospital.
For your mother, you're number what of how many?
One of one.
You are the chosen
the only,
one.
Yes, the only one, the chosen one.
Now, was that intentional that she said, one and done, we're going to have one child?
I think the long-term plan probably was to have more, but I think just between, you know, my mom and dad used to live separately a lot. Like, his work would always be taking him out, and it was enough to just have me. So after a while, it kind of just ended up being the plan, even though it wasn't originally the plan. But it's been really, I think, nice. Obviously, I don't know what it's like to have siblings, but I feel like you have good and bad. All the attention is on you. You're the only child. So you have more resources. You have more time and like, attention. At the same time, maybe more pressure, more expectations, but you balance it out. So I mean, I love being an only child. Again, I don't know what it's like to have siblings.
Was your dad or your mom ever, did they ever say, I wonder what it would be like to have a boy?
You know, I think my dad had wanted a boy originally. I think it's just a traditional Chinese thing. You know, even in the States, the sons carry the last name forward. And so I think there's a little bit of just considering like the legacy, I guess, you know, just never was in the stars for us. But I do think he would have liked to have a boy. And in some ways, I think it benefited me growing up because since I didn't have a brother, he was able to give me some of that attention and some of the raising that he would maybe do a son versus I think if I had a brother, I would have been maybe shunted to more like feminine and more traditional, like girly things like, oh, you shouldn't learn how to, you know, fix the plumbing or like mow the lawn because you should just, you know, figure out how to do more household things. That was never really my upbringing because there wasn't a boy to kind of help take over or help the dad out when things got broke.
Do you know how to fix the plumbing and cut the
grass? Oh, some of it. Yeah, like the garbage disposal, and I know how to like fix up things in the yard and nothing electrical, but I think that's probably for the better. We get professionals for that. But a lot of household things that my mom, you know, is sad that I have to do because I think in her mind, too, she wishes I had less of more traditional male burdens or responsibilities at home. But for me, it's, you know, it's empowering in a way to know how to take care of yourself, take care of your residents, and not have to rely so much on partners or dads or people who usually fulfill those roles.
Did your mother tell you anything about her pregnancy, labor, and delivery with you?
So funny story, in China, what the mother is craving food-wise is kind of an indicator of if it's going to be a boy or a girl, especially back before like ultrasounds and things where you could kind of just look and see. So I think she told me they were expecting twin boys because she got so big, like she just blew up. They're like, oh, you must have like two in there, they must be boys, like really strong. And she was craving, I want to say, spicy food, which meant boy, versus I think if you crave more vinegary food, I think that was girl. That might be swapped, I can't remember. Anyway, she craved one of them, and then lo and behold, a single girl popped out at the end of the day. But she, I think that was so funny for her that, like, you know, her experience and her getting so much bigger and expecting boys, plural, and then having the one was kind of the story I hear growing up all the time.
How many generations have they been in the States?
My parents are the first.
And how old were they when they came here?
I think probably late 20s, maybe 28 or so.
Already married?
Yes, married.
What brought them here?
Partly my mother was, I think, had already had it in her mind for a long time that she wanted to build a life in the U.S. Maybe with stories of opportunity, knowing maybe differences in the education system here. But for whatever reason, she already knew she wanted to come to the States. And I think my father was maybe a little more ambivalent about it, but because she felt so strongly, he was like, okay, like I'll pursue my PhD in the US, which is how they originally got over here on a student visa. And then they built, you know, a life here for as long as I've been here, so almost 27 years now.
So Hattiesburg, they were at University of Southern Mississippi?
That might have, or Mississippi Tech. Okay. My dad's a polymer scientist. I think he was in some type of tech school.
And what did your mother study?
Originally, she was also in chemistry. I think her Chinese undergrad degree was in chemistry. Ultimately, she switched to accounting here. She wanted less bench work, more desk work. She said being pregnant with me was too much work to stand all the time. So she just wanted to find a desk job. And from accounting, she ended up moving into finance, which is what she does now.
Wow. Any pressure from your parents at all to be a doctor?
No. If anything, I think going back a little bit to gender norms, my parents were a little worried that it would be too taxing. Because at the end of the day, like, as the female, you know, I would be the one having to bear a child. And there's a lot of societal pressures in terms of like those early childhood years. A lot of the household burden would fall on me. And to pair that with a challenging profession that might be very time intensive, that's known for burnout, not even known great for, you know, parental leave or parental kind of perks either. I think they were worried that if I was a doctor, it would be too hard. I think at the end of the day, they just want me to be really happy, which I appreciate. You know, they want whatever will make me happiest. So it was kind of nice, though, because at the end of the day, I feel like me pursuing medicine was really internally motivated because I didn't have any pressure. If anything, I had negative pressure from my parents to pursue medicine.
Have you been to China? Have you visited?
I've gone 4 or 5 times every few years.
What part of China are they from? It's a massive place.
Yeah, my mom's from the north, a big industrial port city called Tianjin, about 2 hours north of Beijing. And then my dad's from the south. Chengdu is a huge city in the south.
How did they meet?
In college, yeah.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Brought them together.
Yes.
Yeah. And do you know what attracted them to one another? What appealed to them?
I think my dad was, you know, always the smartest kid on the block. He grew up in a pretty rural area, and it was because of his book studies and his grades he was even able to get out into a big city like Tianjin, which is where they went to college. for my mom, she was a city girl who more or less went to her local college. And so, you know, starting from different points, so therefore kind of the achievement gap in getting to that same college, I think my mom quickly saw how studious and how intelligent and capable my dad was. And, you know, her goal was to get out of the country, and she would need a partner who was able to help her achieve that goal. So I think the initial draw was, oh, this person is very capable, also supportive. They worked in the same lab, and he would always help her out with her experiments and things like that. So that was kind of the starting point of it. Yeah. It's a common immigrant story, I think, is that you know, my mother's generation of people, they come over to the U.S. and they come from very little. You know, my parents always tell me they came with maybe $200 in their pocket, and that was it. And then they built a life here. So I think overcoming those challenges, of course, you always want the best for your children, but especially you want them to do better than you did. You want them to be a step above. So coming here with immigrant parents, or growing up here with immigrant parents, I think that's a really common narrative, that they want you to pursue those very safe jobs of like a doctor or a lawyer, things that have societal social capital, usually have financial security, because those are things that they weren't able to maybe provide for themselves at first, and they want you to have that security. So those pressures aren't always just, oh, I need you to do this because, you know, I think doctors are prestigious and I want that like title for you. But it's more, this job provides security, and I didn't have that, and I wish the best for you, and I wish that security for you. So maybe there's this pressure coming from there.
When somebody said, "Little Alice, what do you want to do when you grow up?" What would you say?
Oh, I had a great line. I think it was like, "I'm going to be a doctor or a lawyer or the president."
Could be all three.
And, you know, yeah, they're like, "Well, why not all of them?" I was like, "Oh, well, that's a good idea too."
Yeah. But you were encouraged. Nobody said, "That's ridiculous. You could never do that." Nobody ever said that.
No. And for, you know, maybe because they didn't take me seriously enough to try to tell me that was like going to be very difficult to achieve all three. But yeah, no one ever overtly was like, "Oh, that's silly."
Where'd you go to high school?
East Chapel Hill High School.
Oh, so how'd they get from Mississippi to Chapel Hill?
We moved a lot, and I think that also was a big part of my childhood and my identity. My dad's job required us to move quite a bit. So from Mississippi, we moved to Cary, North Carolina for a few years, then to Maryland, like D.C. area, Pittsburgh, and then back for high school.
Were you the only Asian kid in the class?
Oh, Asian. Pittsburgh was very white. A lot of Protestant, white Christians. I remember there was maybe a handful of Asians in the entire middle school. And then there was like one Latino boy, I think, also in the entire middle school.
Did you have to put up with stupid questions is what I'm...
Probably. You know, I remember some less than positive experiences that I've had. But overall, also...
Like what?
Like in the mall once in Pittsburgh, you know, I bumped into a lady, and it was a harmless bump. Like I was trying to go look at a shirt or something, and she's like, "Oh my gosh, like go back to China." And I was like, "What?" And as a middle schooler being yelled at by like an adult too, like there's age dynamics. I think it was the first time I had really experienced such overt racism. I've read about it, I've seen it in the news, I've heard other people's stories with really just blatant racism, but I'd never really experienced it, I think, until that point. And I was pretty much stunned, you know, didn't really know how to respond. I was feeling a lot of anger, shock, sadness, maybe some degree of fear. Not for my like physical safety, but just the sense that someone could, you know, seem to hate me so much when I have done so little to her. And my mother luckily was nearby, and she stepped in and kind of, I think, just yelled a little bit at the lady, and then we quickly left the store. But I remember feeling really disappointed that there were workers in the store that were kind of like eyeing us and looked a little uncomfortable, but no one stepped in to say anything. No one was like, "Excuse me, you know, ma'am, like that's inappropriate. We don't tolerate that type of language in our store. Like, you need to leave." There was none of that, which is what I would hope would happen for someone else in that same situation. But yeah, that we didn't get any of that, and we just left. And I think part of it is because the population there is so overwhelmingly, homogeneously white Protestant Christian. So maybe there is just less experience with that type of situation, or maybe there is just less understanding of what, you know, someone could do to be an ally in that situation, but definitely stuck with me.
Did you have high school classmates or college that looked to you to be a kind of interpreter for billions of people, that looked to you to try to, oh, let's ask Alice how, you know, one third of the world lives? Were you ever like leaned on to be the explainer?
I think not too much. Maybe the most would be, you know, if we went to a Chinese restaurant, like, oh, what should we get? Which I think to some people that could be very offensive, but at the same time, like, if I do have more experience in a certain restaurant, which, you know, it wouldn't be out of the question for me to have eaten at, you know, Gourmet Kingdom or like these other Chinese local restaurants more often than they have. I think there are situations where it's acceptable and it's completely fine, especially if you have a lasting relationship and there's an understanding that they're not just trying to stereotype you, but they know enough about your background that they just view you to be an expertise in a field. I think that's very different than someone that doesn't know you as well, that just says, oh, you look a certain way, can you tell me about XYZ? But I really didn't have too many of those experiences. And I think part of it was Chapel Hill is pretty liberal compared to at least the rest of North Carolina. And especially in college, I think I tended to surround myself with people who would more readily recognize the issues with that type of assumption and with those types of stereotypes. So amongst close friends and people that I ended up spending time with, that wasn't a common issue that I had in high school or college.
Does your mother cook traditional dishes?
She does.
And what's your fave? What's your like, I'm coming home, make blank?
Oh, there's so many good ones.
Like for your birthday, what should we?
So for birthdays, you're supposed to have noodles, long noodles to symbolize a long life. So for birthdays, it's kind of, you know, a set menu. But you can always add like dumplings, or usually very festive. Or for New Year's, you're supposed to have fish and then not eat all of it, because the word for fish is also the word for like excess. And so the concept is if you have excess fish for the new year, then your year will be very bountiful, whether it be, you know, back in the day, perhaps crops and yields like that. But if you have that excess, then the rest of your year will be very kind
money.
Of comfortable. Right, right. We have a money tree in our house, actually. It's growing very well.
What's a money tree?
It's just a tree that someone decided to call a money tree. It's definitely not the formal scientific name. But we were gifted one from my dad's coworker, and my mom has very dutifully nourished it over the years, and it's gotten very tall.
Right. Yeah. You live with your mom?
Currently, yeah. When I lived in Durham for med school, I had my own space. But, you know, I would see her all the time. Chapel Hill is only 7 miles away, and as the only child especially, I think we're very close.
There are some girls in particular that have in their teens and 20s especially this break, and sometimes the break is never healed. To what do you attribute your closeness, that you've remained close?
I think a part of it is, well, I would say we had a little bit of a rift when I was in high school.
Over?
Mostly like freedom of the amount of autonomy, I think, granted. And it wasn't usually a question of trust on my mother's end, but I think just maybe cultural differences, like wanting to go to coffee shops to do work, or wanting to have sleepovers every weekend, or, you know, staying out late at night, just hanging out with your friends. It was just not the type of adolescence that my mother had growing up. And so she didn't quite understand why it was necessary or why I would need to do it all the time. You know, like if you had a sleepover 2 months ago, why in the world would you need another one this weekend? So those types of differences would cause some tension. I would see my friends who had maybe more traditional, like American childhoods with a lot more autonomy than what I perceived myself to be getting. So in high school, there was a bit of a tension, but then once I graduated to college and was actually living on my own, those of course went out the door because now I'm living in a dorm. I'm spending my time as I see fit and I'm checking in with my mom and I'm calling her frequently because we are very close, but I don't need to ask for those permissions anymore because of that separation. So as soon as I graduated, I think we were able to get very close again and have maintained that moving, you know, up until now.
My dad's father was a small town doctor. My wife's father was a doctor. And my wife and I both thought we would be pre-med. And we both sucked at the early sciences, the weed out courses.
Sure.
I see doctors all the time who scored really, really high. Like they could tell you organic chemistry all day long, and their bedside manner and their sense of compassion for people is in the toilet.
Yeah.
How do you treat people as people, not to just look at them as sort of numbers or,
right,
or you know, what's on the clipboard?
I think that's the million-dollar question for sure. And.
But how does Alice do it?
You know, this might be a bit of a hot take, but I think it is difficult to learn in medical school. And I think the way admissions is moving now is they are trying to incorporate those softer skills, the ones that are less quantifiable, like compassion, empathy, into the screening process for admissions, as opposed to saying we can ramp it up and teach it better during medical school. The focus is more on let's make sure we're screening for people who have that ability, or at least have enough of that ability that we can nurture it, but you don't have to start from zero. And I think in some ways that makes the most sense. There's so much knowledge, there's so much book knowledge that you need to learn in medical school. You don't have too much excess time to learn anything. And so to teach something that I think is really comes from within and with your personality, with your experiences, with your way you view the world, it's hard to teach someone how to view the world in medical school when you're taking tests all the time on important pathologies that you also need to learn. So I do think screening for it beforehand, having experiences before medical school that really help you grow as a person, that are formative, that allow you to, you know, put yourself in someone else's shoes and say, oh, maybe my own perspective is not the only way to think about it. Let me try to see what it's like from someone else's perspective. That type of soft skill that's so important, I think needs to be developed to some degree before medical school. In medical school, and especially once you've become a practicing provider, I think it's not only hard to develop that skill, but it's hard to maintain whatever you've already developed.
Your classmate Sasha Gumbar was on this podcast,
yeah,
and she pursued law, and she talked about having to recommend a plea to an elderly defendant, which would basically mean he would die in prison.
Mm.
Me and Lorraine, I don't know if you ever heard Colleen talk about Zuzu.
Mm-hmm.
We had to put Zuzu down yesterday.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And the vet was incredible, and the vet tech was in tears and all that. Did you ever have a case like that where you basically were treating someone who was end of life and you were like, we can make you comfortable, but we're not going to perform some heroics?
It's really hard. And I, you know, thinking about one in particular, it always makes me sad. And I think that's part of the strength of being a good doctor is that it should always be a little bit hard. You have to learn how to deal with it and work through it, of course, because at the end of the day, you have other patients to take care of. You can't just time out and leave. So So you have to be able to
have a little meltdown here.
Yeah. I know I'm getting teary, but it
should. Who was this person?
One of my patients.
Man or woman?
A man, elderly man. He was very special to me because I had actually seen him before. I had worked on one of his surgeries for stomach cancer, and he had done pretty well, but as it is with cancer, you know, a lot of cancer comes back, and that was the case for him. And the next time I saw him, I was working in the emergency room, and he came in and he was actively dying. And it was hard because I had, you know, built this relationship with him. So he wasn't just a patient I'd known for 20 minutes. He was a man I'd known for weeks, and now he was dying. And it was comfort care, and it was probably one of the better deaths that you can give someone. I think what you learn quickly in medicine is that it's not always about dying or not dying, but sometimes the more important question, the more valuable question is, can you give someone a good death, like a noble death, a death that they would want? And luckily,
keep them comfortable,
exactly,
minimize suffering, that it's right. Not how many more days you can keep them alive, it's
comfort. Yeah, switching from, you know, trying this intervention or that antibiotic, switching from those more harsh interventions to purely comfort, what keeps the patient comfortable. And sometimes that's the most relieving thing you can do for yourself, for the patient, for the patient's family, who's always a part of that situation and grief as well, is learning when it's right. As a provider, you don't make the decision. We've moved away from, you know, doctor knows best and doctor runs the ship. We've moved towards a integrated, patient-centered, we're part of a team, let's talk about it, what are your values approach. So helping your patient come to terms sometimes with the reality of their physiology. You know, you don't give false hope. You don't say, oh, you have metastatic cancer, but if we just keep giving you chemo, you know, you might get better and live your life like you did. That's not reasonable. It's not realistic. And as the medical provider, your job is to give facts in a field that is really bizarre and foreign to most people. And then they decide. And I think for this patient, I think he had enough time to live and think through the reality of living with cancer that he was ready to move to comfort care, which I think was probably the best decision for him. He was very sick. There was not anything that we could have done to prolong his life. And so I think moving to make sure that he was comfortable was the right decision. And he was comfortable with that decision as well.
What are your observations about kind of the system as it pertains to end of life?
You know, it's interesting because I think although our system and the policies we have in place do value life over anything, you know, the lack of physician assisted suicides, or even though the structures are, you know, very supportive of one thing, which is continuing to live at whatever cost, most of the providers I've worked with tend to skew the other way I wouldn't say skew the other way. I think the providers themselves have a much more well-rounded perspective. Most doctors are not going to say the best thing to do is to keep fighting at all costs all the time, because that's never the whole story. There is human suffering. There is, you know, the desire, as you mentioned, sometimes of saying, you know, I've had enough and I don't want a pacemaker put in at 103. And I think most physicians would say, yeah, like, let's talk about comfort care. Let's talk about what's important to you right now. And based on that, what makes the most sense. But I think where it becomes very tricky is that you don't want to give your patients a sense that you've given up on them. And that's a fine line to draw. Obviously, if you have a very positive relationship, then that's easier. But if you maybe don't know the patient very well, maybe you're just coming on, you're a new doctor, and all of a sudden you're having this conversation and it's like, let's stop care and let's just do pain control. That can be very jarring. As a patient, you don't want to feel like your team has given up on you. The families also don't want to give that sense of, we've given up on you, our loved one. And I think usually the families are the more difficult people to convince that maybe less aggressive interventions are the correct way to go or the best way to go for this particular patient. Because of that guilt, I think. It's very difficult. It's important to talk to families through a death process because there is almost always a sense of guilt. What if I had done this earlier? What if I had, you know, brought them in for a checkup earlier? What if I had done this or that? Or how can I possibly just let them die when there is still more that could be done? That sense of giving up is really hard to get past, even for family members that are doctors that live through this on the other side of things. It's still hard to get past that sense of I'm giving up on someone that I love. And so I think that is also, as much as the structures that are in place for keeping someone alive and maybe not valuing quality of life as much, there are emotional barriers as well that sometimes can muddy the water and maybe delay a transition to something like hospice or comfort care until much later than it needed to be.
Is there a specialty that speaks to you right now?
Kind of generally pediatrics. I'll be starting pediatric residency this month. But within pediatrics, I have not decided yet. I think I'd like to subspecialize in something, maybe adolescent care or hematology oncology, but I haven't had enough experience in those fields, I think, to nail it down. So hopefully my first year of residency, I'll be able to have a clear idea of the future.
Nothing can break your heart like a little kid with cancer.
Yeah, it is really hard. I actually never thought I would like pediatrics in general for that reason, thinking about innocent children living with chronic diseases or very serious acute issues. It just seemed too sad. And then I got into my pediatrics rotation and somehow the meaningfulness of it, the fulfillment you get from helping these children and their families outweighed kind of the horribleness of it all for me. So that's why I ended up choosing pediatrics and maybe the same way with cancer. I'm not sure yet. That might be a different beast, but I'm thinking maybe because it is so meaningful to help kids bounce back. And kids do bounce back a lot better than adults. You know, hemonc is very sad and it can be very depressing, but you have some amazing cases as well that could get you through a week of maybe less ideal bad news, but then you have that one kid that gets cured and you're like, wow, this is amazing.
Well, I was going to say, you've got 8-year-olds who have more courage and have seen more challenges than 80-year-olds. You know, they've been called upon to step up again and again and again. You know, before puberty, they've been called upon to face down death again and again and again. And they become these kind of old souls who just exhibit, you know, they're inspirational to some of these kids. It's amazing.
Right, yeah. And at the end of the day, you know, you choosing or not choosing to do a field doesn't mean that there won't be kids who don't have cancer, right? If there are no cancer doctors for children, there will still be patients that are children who have cancer. And so if I think I can do a good job, if I think I can be that really supportive, empathetic physician to a kid who's going through a really tough time, it's worth it to me, I think. When I get there, I'll let you know. But I think it would be worth it to stomach some of that unfairness in the world to say, at least I'm caring for someone who needs to be cared for.
How do you get trained to not become burnt up or burnt out? To not become so thick-skinned that you're no longer capable of, you know, kind of human compassion that you need?
That's another $1 million question. If you figure out the answer, let all of the medical schools and hospitals know.
How does Dr. Alice do that?
You know, for me, I think what has been effective so far and what I plan to hold on to moving forward as I see more and more is preventative care. Trying to be readily, you know, honest with the pressures that come to you before they get to you. Understanding the effects that loss and trauma can have before it's already kind of sunk itself into you. The more, like through medical school, for example, I used to think all the time about how one of my biggest fears was losing my empathy and becoming cold and becoming tired and being someone who I didn't want to be. And I worried so much about it that I think it was very protective for me because I was always checking in with myself. Oh, like, am I acting cranky because I'm tired, or am I hungry, or, you know, am I still giving this patient the benefit of the doubt that I think they deserve, despite, you know, all these other things that maybe are going on in my life? I don't want it to bleed into my relationships with my patients. And I was always doing that check-in, and I think it worked. Hopefully it worked. I'm a firm advocate of having a therapist, even if you don't think there's something acutely that you need to work through, just having someone that knows you well, that you can always talk to, touch base. Everyone has stress in their life. Everyone, therefore, can benefit, I think, from having a therapist. The other thing that has been effective is having mentors, whether that be people much older than you and, you know, mid-career, late career, or having simply, you know, other residents, other med students just a year or two ahead of you that can say, you know, I've been in a similar situation. Do you want to talk about it? This is how I felt at the time. If you need an ear, like, I'm here for you. Those interpersonal relationships are, I think, one of the mainstays as well that I've seen in the healthcare profession. And it can be very effective. And I think part of the reason they're so effective is because it's hard to standardize something preventative of burnout in medicine. People process differently. People have different thresholds or different ways that support can be effective for them. So I think standardizing it has been really challenging and ineffective, and there's not really good prevention of burnout at a macro level. And so you kind of have to rely on those smaller levels of support, friends, family, coworkers, therapists. That's what I've seen in my experience.
I was treated once by a guy who would prod my feet, poke my feet really hard, and tell me about the health of my internal organs based on pinching and poking my feet. What a lot of people will just like dismiss something like that out of hand. I'm wondering, what is Chinese medicine, and what, if anything, does it have to teach Western medicine?
It's a really good question, and I think I have tried to develop my approach to that over the past many years, and I'm still working on kind of how I integrate more or less traditional Western healthcare into how I view health. Which is a long way of saying I don't have the perfect answer, but from just growing up at home and having more traditional medicines and things that I used, you know, as a kid growing up, I think I've always been more open-minded to the less, quote, Westernized medicine that exists in the world. And I think there is a strong stigma that's, I don't know exactly where it comes from, maybe xenophobia or something, but there definitely is a stigma that's widely prevalent towards things that seem more traditional or, what is the word, like naturopathic. And, you know, I think number one is acknowledging that that exists. And then the second, I think, is to kind of dial that back to saying the same way that my values aren't necessarily my patient's values, and that's okay and that's correct. I can't impose my values on someone, is allowing space for people to have their own beliefs, and that could include healing traditions. If someone has something that you're not familiar with as a Western doctor, but has worked for them much of their life. And, you know, it's something that they believe in. And I just can't imagine a situation where you have the position to say, that's wrong, stop. You know, unless it's maybe something that there's data for. But I think data and research is another issue when it comes to Western medicine versus non-Westernized medicine, is that a lot of that stigma comes from, oh, well, we have data about XYZ, so therefore your herb that you're using, or your process that you're doing for labor or whatever, there's no data for it, so therefore it must be fake. But I think the arrogance of saying, after thousands and thousands of years of some culture allowed this particular herb or this particular medicine or this particular way or process, if it has survived thousands of years of another culture, how can you just dismiss it so quickly, right? Like, there must have been something that allowed that particular thing to continue on for generations.
There's more to Alice Yu than the MD, so I would be remiss if I didn't say, favorite Broadway musical?
Oh, that's so hard. When I lived in New York for my gap year, I tried to go all the time, and everything blew my socks off. I would probably say Carol King, the musical, or is it called A Beautiful Life, Carol King? I can't remember, but it's about Carol King, and it was my favorite because I did not know Carol King at all before going in. I tried to get lottery tickets, failed, ended up looking for the cheapest Broadway tickets I could find since I was already there. Went in, no idea, no expectations, and it just blew me away. The music, the acting, the dancing, the story, I think was really brought it all together for me, is being able to hear these songs in relation to the events going on in her life. Added such depth to each already beautiful, work of music. And I came out of it a huge Carole King fan, obviously.
Did you buy Tapestry, or did you download Tapestry?
I did. On Spotify, I was listening to it on repeat for a couple weeks.
One of the greatest albums ever.
And I had, never heard of it before.
I put it next to Joni Mitchell Blue.
Oh, really? Yeah. Joni Mitchell is also a great one. Yeah. One of the greats. So.
Your senior solo in the a cappella group was...
John Legend, something about you're gonna miss me when I'm gone. I don't even know what it was called anymore.
And you chose that because?
I think it was, I love John Legend. I love his voice. He's very soulful. It was a good range for me as an alto. And also, I thought it had a bit of, graduation sentimental vibes. Like, I'm leaving, but I've loved you all, and we've had this beautiful time together, and something along those lines.
Most overdone cliche of an a cappella song that you would veto, you would blackball if they brought it up.
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I think I'm the type who would never say never, so I would never veto something completely. I could always be convinced into it. But in terms of maybe corny song, I'm thinking of one that we did. Brown Eyed Girl, I think, is done a lot. But it's a good song, and I would never say you shouldn't do it. But it is done often in the a cappella world.
Were there a cappella arrangements that really surprised you, that you said, oh, that's not an a cappella song, you can never do that? And then you saw, wow, I could never believe that they turned it into a cappella, but they did it.
Yeah, there was one, I saw a Harvard a cappella group doing this jazz, I don't even know what the song was, but I think jazz as a style is difficult to really capture with human voices, and so, for better or for worse, maybe I was a little bit too close-minded to it. My group probably could have pulled it off.
But jazz gave us scat. It gave us, that
right,
kind of...
Right, right. I mean, the vocals, of course, could be replicated, but I think the instrumental, atmosphere of jazz music, having, the soft drums with the little, I don't know what it's called, looks like a brush, maybe it's called a brush, on the drums, or having the cello, which you can maybe replicate with a bass. But I think I've always considered it very hard to replicate an acapella, but I did see this group do a very good job with it and kind of changed my mind about the concept.
Is hip hop underrepresented in acapella nowadays? Overrepresented? About right?
I am not the expert on the matter. I would say my group did some hip hop. I think it's important to be cognizant also of who's in your group and who's performing, who's representing, like the song and the story you're trying to tell. Like there are some songs, Strange Fruit comes to mind immediately, where if you didn't have any black singers in your acapella group to sing that song, seems like it's out of your, like it's not something that you could do respectfully.
I get
per se.
It. I've had a singer on this podcast,
yeah,
who was African American, talk about the appropriation of Strange Fruit.
Right.
Written by a white man.
Oh, I didn't even know that. So yeah, you know, I think that when it comes to song selection, part of it is just what do you like, what do you want to sing? But there should be a lot of attention and thought that goes into what is appropriate for us to sing as well. You know,
I'm not saying white men should sing it.
Yes, yes.
I'm not saying white men should sing it. I'm saying it has a very unusual history, that song.
Right, right. Yeah. Same thing with, you know, we had really beautiful songs that were written by gay artists, mm-hmm, that were about their story, their experience of being gay. And, you know, I personally think it would sit a little uneasy with me if we didn't have any gay members in our group, which was not the case. We did. And then also to have someone sing it as a soloist that didn't really understand the message of it. There's a lot with music, beyond the notes and the lyrics, the intention and the story. You need to be true to that, whatever it is. So with hip hop, you know, I think you can pull off hip hop without being a fully black group. You know, that's not what I'm saying at all. But I think being intentional and being thoughtful about maybe the song, the meaning behind it, the artist, the story, before you go and do something without thinking about it.
If we get struck by lightning today,
sure. Oh,
and the only thing that survives is this little piece of audio, what is your legacy?
I think when I think of legacy, I think of the relationships you build in your life. And, you know, if we got struck by lightning, hopefully not everyone else got struck by lightning. And I think living in the memories of my friends and my loved ones is the best that I could probably do for this world.
Dr. Alice Yu, I think you'll make a superb physician.
Thank you.
I think you already do. I think you have compassion and everything. Thank you for making time.
Oh, of course. This has been great. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Alice Yu, it is a privilege to know you and to get to know you through my youngest two kids, Jack and Colleen. And they're big Alice Yu fans from a long ways back, all the way back to the undergrad days. And then she's off to the big city to do bigger and better things. Thank you, Dr. Alice. I appreciate you.
In Her Words is a production of the Queen City Podcast Network in cooperation with Balto Creative Media. Allison Andrews at Andrews Creative, Rachel Clapp Miller and Roshonda Pratt are developmental producers. Sally Higgins at Higgins and Owens tries to keep us legal. Our music is A Day at the Park by the group Pictures of the Floating World. Your announcer is Catherine Smith. That's me. If you like what you hear, please subscribe and take a moment to rate and review. It really helps others find us. If you love us, go to our Patreon page at patreon.com. Look for Man Listening, one word, no spaces. A small investment makes a big difference in lifting up the voices of women.
A huge shout out and thank you to everyone who has supported me as we near 200 episodes of this podcast, going into, after January, our fifth year. Unbelievable. Thanks so much.
Thank you for your support. We believe one voice can change the conversation. Thanks so much.